It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at a new study that shows more and more people are giving the driver's license a pass.
But first, Iowans caucused last night, giving us the first real results in the long state-by-state road to the presidential nominations.
Tonight is a victory for courageous conservatives across Iowa and all across this great nation.
I will always work to achieve the America that I believe in, where the promise of that dream that we hold out to our children and our grandchildren never fades.
We finished second, and I want to tell you something. I'm just honored. I'm really honored.
And while the results are still not complete, it looks like we'll have about half of the Iowa delegates.
Just heard from Texas Senator Ted Cruz, then former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, both of whom claimed a victory last night, then runners-up Donald Trump and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Joining us now to discuss last night's Iowa caucus is Don Gagne. He's national political correspondent for NPR, a familiar voice to our listeners. Don, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, in elections past, I think there's sometimes a tendency to overread Iowa, maybe draw too many lessons. Do you see that happening so far this time as people look at the results?
Oh, yeah. We always have to be careful of that. And here's the way I look at it. Yes, it was a great night for Ted Cruz. It was a great night when he really didn't need to have a great night, because imagine if he had finished second or third. People would be saying, well, if Cruz can't win Iowa, where can he win? So, a good night for Ted Cruz, but it doesn't necessarily predict anything for him going forward. Otherwise, we might have a President Rick Santorum now. He was the last winner of the Republican Iowa caucus. Or President Mike Huckabee, who was the winner 4 years before him. So that's Cruz. Donald Trump, it is a little bit of a reality check for Trump. We have seen the crowds he's drawing, and we've seen his poll numbers, but these are actual votes, actual people saying, yes, I support this person. And it's not that Donald Trump needed to win Iowa, but he wanted to win Iowa. And, just generally speaking, the mood around their campaign is that they expected to win Iowa, and they did. So reality check there. The one who it may be most meaningful for is the third place finisher, Marco Rubio. You say third place. Well, what does that get you? Well, it makes him the leading of the, so-called more mainstream Republicans. And it's not just that he finished ahead of Jeb Bush and John Kasich and Chris Christie and those others in the contest, but he far exceeded expectations. If you look at what he did, 24, almost 25%, I think, with the final numbers, compared to the, 15% that he had in most recent polls. There's the preamble.
Well, Don, when our own Governor Scott Walker dropped out of the presidential race, he encouraged other more establishment candidates to drop out, unite around one, in effect, non-Donald Trump candidate. Do you see that maybe actually happening now? Some of those people who fell well behind Marco Rubio maybe going to bow out, try to unite around one candidate to displace Trump and Cruz?
Well, we did get late last night former Governor Mike Huckabee bowing out, suspending his campaign. Mm-hmm. And then we had Martin O'Malley on the Democratic side. But the Republican governors have been putting most of their energy into New Hampshire. John Kasich and Chris Christie weren't even in Iowa yesterday on the day of the Fox thing. They were already looking ahead to a week from today, the vote in New Hampshire. And Jeb Bush has also been spending most of his time in New Hampshire. So none of them are going to drop out before they get this chance to show their stuff in a state that is far less, evangelical, far less dominated by Christian conservatives on the Republican side. they want to see what they can do with New Hampshire, live free or die, kind of pro-business Republicans.
Before we move on from the Republicans in Iowa, a big turnout among evangelicals and other Republicans, record turnout, I think, which people thought is going to be good news for Donald Trump. Well, it kind of was, but Rubio and Cruz got a lot of those newcomers, too. So maybe, do you think Trump motivated a lot of people to show up and vote for him and a lot of other people to show up and vote against him?
I think that's a pretty fair theory. I've not had a chance to dive into some of the internals and the crosstabs on the entrance polls that were being conducted as people went in to vote. There was huge turnout. 180,000 Republicans when their previous record was a third less than that. So something drove them out. Certainly it was the really significant and well-organized ground game that Ted Cruz had. I did talk to people caucusing who had never caucused before, who were voting for Trump, and who were inspired by him and liked him and liked his attitude and liked his whole approach, his kind of take no prisoners, nobody can buy me approach. So I think he certainly did turn new people out, but I think it's an excellent question. How many people did he inspire to get out to vote for somebody else?
Talking to Don Gagne from NPR News about the results from Iowa last night. And on the other side, this was a nail-biter on the Democratic side. Hillary Clinton won, but not by much. And in the expectation game, that people are looking at this as a disappointment for the Clinton campaign, aren't they?
Yes, to some degree. But look, she gets to leave Iowa saying she won Iowa. It was by a whisker, and in a half dozen places, half a dozen precincts around the state, it was a coin toss that determined
literally
who that kind of extra odd delegate would go to, because it was essentially a tie. In a place where they have an odd number of delegates and it's a tie, like say they have 21 delegates, well, then Clinton would get 10 and Sanders would get 10, and they have to have some mechanism to decide who gets the one that's left over. Again, that's not in every precinct. It's not at every caucus site, but it was in about a half a dozen places, and that's when they would do the coin toss. And that really was the difference for her, but it allows Hillary Clinton to get on her plane, taxi down the tarmac at the Des Moines airport, and take off knowing that she won Iowa, even if it was by a whisker. And that's a lot better than losing Iowa by a whisker, because at that point she would be a two-time Iowa caucuses loser. So I guess that's the way to look at it. And the poll did show that it was close, so everybody expected it to be close.
New Hampshire a week off. They've got one of their neighbors there in Bernie Sanders, and he's doing pretty well in the polls. Hillary Clinton may be counting on South Carolina. What do you make of those two states?
New Hampshire, Senator Sanders does have, a bit of a home court advantage. It's not just that New Hampshire is right next to his state of Vermont. They're both small states, and they all get kind of the same TV stations and a lot of the same media and same radio and everything else. And people just know him up there, and he knows the place. So that does give him an advantage. And there is, a bit of a tradition in American politics for the home court advantage, meaning something. I don't know how much. But he's been polling really well there. So it is something that made Clinton getting that teeny, teeny sliver of a victory, and it is a victory because she did get more delegates in Iowa, even more important for her because she still have a harder time getting that in New Hampshire. And then you look ahead to South Carolina, where on the Democratic side, there are a lot of African American votes, a lot of minorities, and those are voters that she has traditionally done well with, that she and her husband have done well with, if you go back many years. So it does feel like the advantage is hers when you get down there.
And Don, before I let you go, if I can inject a personal note, we've been talking about polls, reading tea leaves, signs importance for a while now. As a guy who does this for a living, what's it like to have some real results to chew on?
Oh, man, it's just like, oh, finally some numbers, finally some things that you know, represent an actual voter, you know, marking a piece of paper or at least standing up and being counted in the case of Iowa. Again, it's just one state. It's a small state. It's not a state that's representative of the rest of the country. But at least now we know we're actually counting votes, and we're going to get more to count in a week in New Hampshire.
And are you going to get some sleep tonight to make up for last night?
My flight, if I get out of here, because it's snowing here in Des Moines. Yeah, I mean, you're getting some bad weather there, too. I heard Noah's newscast. I hope I get out of here tonight. But either there or here, I will get some sleep. And maybe some of it will be on the tarmac and changing planes or something.
Well, Don, I don't want to keep you from beating the snow or getting sleep. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Keep up the good work there. And we'll see you guys, I guess, a couple of months or a month or so down the line.
Sounds good.
Get there. Okay.
That's Don Gagne, national political correspondent for NPR, bringing us up to date on last night's Iowa caucus and what's still to come.
Coming up, there's been a drop in the number of people getting their driver's license. You're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk with Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin about why she thinks tax inversion mergers need to be regulated and restricted.
First, learning how to drive used to be a rite of passage, a sign that a teenager was growing up and becoming an adult. Today, though, the number of people getting a driver's license is in decline across all age groups, according to a study that looked at the years 2011 through 2014.
The largest declines coming from young people, with a 47% drop among 16-year-olds since 1983. There are declines across the board, with the smallest decrease for people over 55. The results of the study raise the question, has driving peaked in the United States?
Julie Beck joins us now. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she wrote about the decline of the driver's license. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, let's look at the numbers a bit here. So big picture, is it fair to say that the driver's license is just not as big a deal as it used to be?
I think it is fair to say that with some caveats, as always. So there was a decrease in every age group between 2011 and 2014, but they also looked back to 1983. And so when you look at the sort of larger time span, it gets a little more complicated. Over that whole period, driver's licenses for young people, for teens, went down steadily throughout the whole time period. But for older people, especially... I want to say 55 and older, they increased a little bit from 1983, and then between 2011 and 2014, they did go down. So they kind of went up and then went down a little bit.
Well, how big a drop are we seeing in, say, younger people who are not getting a driver's license?
Yeah, so the biggest drop is... as you said, 47% decrease among 16-year-olds. And then even when you get to the end of the teen years, among 19-year-olds, you see a 21% decrease. So it seems like the older age groups, you know, it's declining less as you get older. So mostly among teens, but you do see it among young adults as well.
And what about people in that age group we were talking about, over 55?
Yeah, so they were more likely to have a driver's license in 2014 than in 1983. So the overall trend over the past few decades has been going up. But they also saw a small decline between 2011 and 2014. So it seems like in those years, it was sort of a decline for everybody. But overall, older adults are getting more licenses over a longer period. And that may be just because people are living longer or being healthier. It's hard to say.
I know there's still a lot of speculation that the studies haven't had a chance to dig in real deep, but what do we know about why people might be deciding not to get a driver's license?
Yeah, so the same researchers who did this study on the numbers also did a survey only among young adults age 18 to 39, so it doesn't really get into the older adult issue, but they asked, you know, those people without driver's license why they didn't have them. And you might suspect, or at least I suspected, that it might have something to do with sort of urbanization and public transit, but only 17% of those young adults said that they preferred public transit. That's why they didn't have a license. The reasons that they were more likely to say was that they were just too busy to get a driver's license, it was too expensive to have a car, or they could just get transit from other people.
What's interesting about this is that you sort of expect it to be one of these stories about millennials, like millennials not getting their driver's license anymore, and this is something that might be unique to that cohort of people. But it does seem, as you say, to be true across all age groups, at least through the last 3 years or so. Do you think that's kind of remarkable in a way?
Yeah, I think that there is, it seems like there's an overall trend away from driving a little bit. So in other studies that these same researchers have done, they've sort of looked at distance driven per person, and that was at its highest in 2004. And so between 2004, when people were driving the most, and 2013, it had gone down by 9%. So even among people who have cars and they have driver's license, it seems like they aren't driving around quite as much.
We're talking right now with Julie Beck, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, where she writes about health and psychology. Right now, we're talking about the decline of the driver's license, younger people least likely to get a driver's license or having the biggest declines in the number of driver's licenses that they're getting. And then as the ages go up, those declines decrease, but still a story here about fewer people getting their driver's license. And big picture, what do you think about this says about the country being car dependent, people being attached to their cars and driving a lot?
I think it's still hard to say. I think there's a lot of things that are probably going into it, and this is just me speculating because there hasn't really been great research on this. I mean, I think probably people moving to cities is a little bit of it. I think there may be, sort of the rise of teleworking as an element for why people are driving less generally, whether, you know, they have their license or not. It could be some of those things. It could be unemployment. It could be people can't afford cars. I think there's probably a lot of things going into it, and so it's going to be hard to pinpoint anything and say that, you know, this is why people are kind of giving up their cars.
As we talk about the decline of the driver's license, we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is this something that resonates with you? Have you put off getting a driver's license or decided not to get one at all? And if so, why did you make that choice? It's 800-642-1234. And you're talking, Julie, about telecommuting, that maybe being a factor here. You also talk about how maybe people are just staying at home more. You've got your Amazon delivering everything to your house. You've got Netflix. So why do people even need to leave their houses? What do you think about that possibility?
Again, I think it's a possibility. You know, it's one of those things I can't say with any certainty unless somebody studies it. But, in the same study about, driving kind of having peaked, people were traveling less overall, and that's not only driving, you know, it's taking the bus, it's flying, it's whatever, but there was less time spent traveling to go out and eat, to go buy, you know, goods and services, to go out for leisure activities, anything like that. People were just traveling less, and that may be because you can get a lot of those things done without leaving the house.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Maureen on the line in Mineral Point. Maureen, hi.
Hi. One of the things that sounds like it could absolutely be a factor in fewer people getting their driver's license. I was on the school board in Mineral Point, and we had to look at ways of offering driver's ed. Some schools, kids have to pay for it now. Some schools, the schedule has to be handled off school hours. When I was in school, I learned had driver's ed during the school day. And I would guess that the budget cuts at the state level that are impacting schools and therefore having fewer offerings are actually one of the bigger causes to fewer people getting their license these days.
Maureen, so interesting. Thank you for that. So is it about driver's ed programs and budget shortfalls at schools, Julie, do you think?
It could be. You know, that's not something that they really looked into, but I mean, you do notice that there is a bigger decline among young people, like 16, 17, 18-year-olds, and that, you know, they do need to have driver's ed. I'm not sure what the laws are in Wisconsin, but in Michigan, where I got my license, at least at the time, when you were 18, you could just take the driver's test without having necessarily done all of the driver's ed. So then, you know, that there's less of, you could say if that's good or bad, but there's less of a barrier there at least to getting it when you're 18 than when there is when you're 16 or 17.
And we're going to go next to Mike in Madison. Maureen, thank you for that call. And Mike, hi.
Hi. Two quick things. So first off, I think that nowadays the majority of the states have gone to a private driver's school for the kids. And at least for my nephew, they taught him almost nothing. They taught him the bare minimums to pass the test. and really no driving skills. And that makes you wonder why teens are getting twice as many accidents as they did when we were young, because they're not being taught. Secondly, I wanted to go buy him a car for his 16th birthday. But, you know, I was going to make him pay. I was going to put everything down for him, and he'd have to pay the insurance and the rest of the payments on the car. But the way it worked out is the insurance alone on the car was more than the actual car payment. The car payment would have been around $270 a month, and his insurance for that was going to cost him around $330 a month. That puts him in a grand total of $600 a month for a used car. I couldn't even afford that. So unfortunately, he didn't get a car for his 16th birthday. He's just going to have to figure it out like the rest of the teens.
Oh, Mike, great points there. So what about the cost of having a car? And insurance, especially for teenagers, is the cost of it just getting prohibitive? Is that what people are saying, Julie?
Yeah, well, that was the second highest reason that people said in that survey, the survey of people who didn't have licenses. The second highest reason was, owning and maintaining a vehicle is too expensive. They didn't differentiate between the cost of the actual car and the cost of insurance, but you know, I'm sure that that's what people are thinking about when they say maintaining a vehicle.
And Julie, just real quick before we let you go, what do you think is going to take the place? It was just sort of a benchmark of adulthood. Now without the driver's license for some kids, what do you think could take its place?
Oh, the last time I was here, we talked about adulthood. I don't know what would take its place. I think that actually, having a car, whether you got your license or not, you know, a lot of teens haven't been able to afford a car always. So I think the benchmarks of adulthood today are kind of more self-determined. So, you know, it could be moving out of your parents' house. It could be starting college, anything like that.
Julie, thanks a lot.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Julie Beck, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. She joined us to talk about why fewer people across all age groups are getting their driver's license.
Coming up, Senator Tammy Baldwin joins us to look at the impact of corporate tax inversions on the state and the nation. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance about the recent news that Wisconsin's collected tax revenues will be significantly less than initial projections.
First, Wisconsin company Johnson Controls recently announced that they'll be merging with Tyco International. The new firm will maintain its operational headquarters in Milwaukee, but its legal global headquarters will move to Ireland. That change of address is expected to mean $150 million less in U.S. taxes that will be paid each year. The merger is also expected to save the company's $500 million in the first 3 years.
This particular type of merger is called a corporate inversion. The purpose is for an American company to merge with a foreign company, which is often the smaller of the two, but then charter the new entity in the home country with more favorable corporate tax rates. Johnson Controls is just the most recent example of this type of maneuver.
Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin is a co-sponsor of legislation that would make it harder to do that. Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to join you.
What was your first reaction when you heard about the Johnson Control merger with Tyco?
Well, my first reaction was, where are they going to have their official corporate headquarters? Because we quickly learned that this was going to constitute a corporate inversion, which is a sort of fancy phrase for moving your headquarters to take advantage of tax loopholes that allow you not to pay U.S. corporate taxes. And that's of great concern to me. I certainly have lots of other questions about the Johnson Controls Tyco merger with regard to jobs in Wisconsin and how they will be impacted, the spinoffs they're planning, and all of those things that I hope to dig into at greater length. But the headline of the corporate inversion caused me great distress.
Now, you're a co-sponsor of the Stop Corporate Inversions Act of 2015. What would change if that measure becomes law?
Well, it would prohibit many companies that use this tax loophole from doing so. You can purchase, it seems, or merge with a small company based overseas and rid yourself of the obligation to pay U.S. taxes on very sizable portions of your corporate profits. And, you know, in my mind, corporate tax inversions are a perfect example of how the game is rigged and why we need tax reform that focuses on rewarding work instead of just wealth. But if we think about the impact, in this case, I've heard it written in the coverage of this proposed merger that up to $150 million could be, you know, not paid in corporate federal taxes. Well, what does this mean? It means that tax dollars that provide tax credits for research and development or investments in transportation infrastructure, things that these companies rely on, are going to be shouldered, or the burden's going to have to be shouldered by individual taxpayers and other corporations that remain headquartered in the U.S.
Now, some business leaders have said that this kind of tax aversion, corporate inversion, is essentially logical business sense, that taxes are higher here, so you relocate to a country with lower taxes. In Ireland, for instance, where Johnson Controls is relocating their 12.5% to the U.S.'s 35%, what do you say to that?
Well, I say a couple of things. First of all, we just have to get the facts right, and because there are so many loopholes written into the tax code, you know, that it's been rigged in a way that even though the marginal rate in the U.S. is higher for corporations than in other countries, the effective rate, what they actually end up paying, is often much lower. And we've seen headlines over the past decade or so about some of the most profitable companies on earth, you know, based in the U.S., paying almost none in corporate tax. And so that's, you know, that's very, very troublesome to me, especially, again, when the burden becomes shifted to families and individuals who, as we all know, have seen very little increase in their salaries and wages in recent years. So, you know, these are loopholes for the most profitable. They clearly are rigging the system in a way that rewards wealth, not the hard labor and work that American families, engage in. I think, additionally, many of these same companies that are inverting have reaped the benefit of federal tax credits for their, their research and development and other activities, and now don't want to pay their fair share towards those very benefits that they've enjoyed. So it's very troublesome to me.
Senator Ron Johnson has said that the answer is to lower corporate taxes. He says that takes away the incentive companies have to move their headquarters out of the country. Is that a straightforward solution?
You know, I certainly support the enterprise of tax reform. We have a system right now that is riddled with loopholes, oftentimes as a result of the lobbying of powerful interests to rewrite the rules. And so I certainly support tax reform, but I support corporate tax reform in a form that is that brings greater fairness within the U.S. tax system, that rewards work, not just wealth, and demands that everyone do their fair share for the investments we want to make. And so I don't just look at, you know, the United States versus this country or that country. I look at what we all need to do to pitch in together and to have a fair tax system.
We're talking with Senator Tammy Baldwin right now, talking about corporate tax inversions. And I want to read a quote of yours here. In a statement, you had said powerful special interests have rigged the rules with corporate tax loopholes like inversions. Again, a reference to special interests. What special interests are you referring to?
Almost depends on the loophole that you're talking about. Sometimes it's narrow groups of folks. Let's take, for example, the carried interest tax loophole. That tax loophole allows hedge fund managers on Wall Street and elsewhere some private equity firms to pay a lower tax rate than many hard workers in our society, teachers, truck drivers, nurses. That is a very narrow loophole, but it is impactful. And it's certainly an example of a loophole that places a greater value, societal value, on wealth than on hard work. And that's something that we should bring an end to, which is why I introduced the legislation to close that very, very loophole.
And what kind of response have you been seeing in Wisconsin for the Stop Corporate Inversions Act that you've co-sponsored?
For that, I think that because we are a state that has seen dozens of corporate inversions in the last decade, many of which involved Wisconsin businesses that employ significant numbers of people in our state, that there is great support for bringing greater scrutiny to this. I think of some of the larger examples of that. We have Eaton Corp from Milwaukee, Trane in La Crosse, now this proposal where Johnson Controls would invert, but Tyco, which employs many people in Wisconsin, has already done so, and that's, that's troublesome already. You know, they started in the 90s when Tyco turned itself into a subsidiary of a very small firm from Bermuda and shifted its tax address to Bermuda. And then it moved to Switzerland and then Ireland in 2014. This is very problematic, especially when these corporations benefit from the tax expenditures in the United States.
And before we let you go, Senator Baldwin, last night, obviously the Iowa caucus results coming in a bit of a surprise to a lot of people. Ted Cruz coming out on top for the GOP and an essential dead heat for Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. What did you make of the results?
Well, let's start with the Democratic side. I would say that, first of all, the turnout was higher than many predicted, and I think that means that the Democratic activists in Iowa were very engaged. I expect us to see that throughout this country as the presidential primary progresses. You know, I think as we, you may know and your listeners may know that I have endorsed Hillary Clinton. I'm a strong supporter of hers. And I think as we move to other states this spring, Hillary Clinton's advantages will become more and more clear. I think she worked hard. She listened. She proposed solutions to the problems that she heard about. And so I think that this is, this is something that we're going to see her strengths and her advantages become more clear throughout the primary season. I think that the polls were all wrong with regard to the Republican side. It was interesting to see how many predicted a different result, that Trump would win rather than Ted Cruz. So I think a lot of people are trying to understand why that was and what that means.
Senator Baldwin, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau recently reported that Wisconsin's net general fund balance at the end of the current two-year budget will be $94.3 million under projections. In large part, that's because of a shortfall in estimated tax collections. While they're still projecting a surplus, it will be significantly smaller than originally thought.
Joining us now to talk about whether this lower estimate is cause for concern, what it might mean for Wisconsin taxpayers, is Todd Berry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. Thank you.
So these numbers are revised downward. This happens from time to time. What accounts for this this big difference, $94.3 million?
Well, a lot of this has to do with perspective. We should probably start with saying the reduction in tax revenues is actually bigger. It's closer to $160 million, but there's some offsetting savings that are helping. And, you know, in the scheme of things, when you're spending $15, $16 billion a year, $50, $100 million, is not a huge amount of money. However, the problem is, our budgets have been so narrowly balanced for so long that even a little hiccup puts us sort of on the edge of some danger. So we had this ending balance of $70 million amounts to less than a half of 1% of what we spend. In other words, if there's any kind of error on spending or revenue estimates, we're really potentially in deficit problem again, which has sort of been the problem under both Democrats and Republicans for the last 10 to 15 years.
And Todd, you have been talking about this idea. A lot of people have been talking about this. We need cushion in the budget.
Yeah.
We need a rainy day fund in the budget. We need it planned out. We're not where you want to see us be with that rainy day fund, are we?
Well, let's just, for the sake of listeners, say that there's sort of two reserves. There's a statutory reserve, which the legislature many years ago had put on a path to grow to 2% of spending, never mind that they never observed the law, nor did the governors. The other is the true rainy day fund, and that was established in 1986, and despite what this governor and the prior governor of opposing parties said, neither has ever appropriated a penny to the rainy day fund prospectively. In other words, they have never said, I'm going to set aside money before I begin to budget. What they've done, and they've only done this because they've been required by law, the law says when you beat your tax estimates that you have to put half of it into the rainy day fund. And that's exactly what happened a few years back when Governor Walker had gone through some really tough, difficult, austerity kinds of budgets. The economy grew and we had some extra revenue, and some of that had to go into the rainy day fund. But just to put this in some kind of larger national and historic perspective, no matter how you look at these numbers, the current reserves are not large compared to other states, and they're not large compared to where we were back in 2008 when the prior governor was also skating on the edge. So we've never, regardless of party, been able to get into our heads that we cannot forecast the economy, which means we can't forecast tax revenues, which means the way you get around this is you have some money set aside to handle a surprise. Every little surprise for us is potentially a crisis because we never plan ahead.
Talking to Todd Berry from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance about revised budget numbers, lower tax collections, taking away some of the wiggle room we had in our current state budget. Todd, let's get into those tax projection shortfalls.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans saying, hey, we're still on budget, not a huge deal. Democrats saying, this is a sign that the state's going wrong in the economy. We're not raising enough money. Do you see this as a long-term concern? We're not going to be bringing in as much revenue? Or is this a blip, an unpredictable blip?
Well, let's first of all say it wasn't unpredictable. In fact, we put out a piece last May, before the budget was passed, and said that in looking at the U.S. Commerce Department, and looking at the Wall Street Journal, and looking at the Federal Reserve Bank, and looking at the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, and looking at the Department of Revenue's own forecast, every one of those was telling us in May of 2015 that it appeared the economy was slowing. And at the time, we said maybe before the legislature passes the budget, it should think about revising its revenue estimates down a little bit and getting ready to for some kind of shock. They did not do that. And what we see with the actual inflation-adjusted numbers on the economy is that, indeed, in the third quarter last year, the economy grew 1 percentage point less than it was supposed to, and 1.5 percentage points less in the fourth quarter, which in the fourth quarter was about a two-thirds drop in the growth that was expected. So the economy did slow at the end of last year, just as a lot of people were telling us last spring, we just didn't do anything about it.
Well, Todd, looking ahead, there's no talk, I think, of a budget repair bill because there's not a shortfall in this current budget. There's talk that, hey, maybe some of the stuff we're going to spend a little extra money on might not be able to happen. Do you recommend any kind of change in behavior from lawmakers, from the governor, in response to these revised numbers?
Well, I would say the same thing I've said about every legislature and every governor for the last 20 years, which is, you know, if you keep ideally 4, 5, 6% of what you spend in a reserve, you can absorb these little surprises, but we just don't have that ability, and it's too late now to build a reserve because we're sort of sitting on the edge. Certainly I would say that if they are going to pass any more legislation that either reduces revenues or increases spending, they better have some sense that they're going to make it to the end of next year, the mid next year, the fiscal year, with some cash on hand, and again, $70 million to spare in the balance is just a few days of tax revenues if we get hit with a surprise.
Todd, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Todd Barry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, talking about revised state budget numbers that predict a $158 million drop in tax collections during our current budget cycle.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Harry Enten from 538.com tells us where polling went wrong and right in the Iowa caucuses and what it all means for the road to the White House.
Disney princesses can have a big influence on children, but here's a thing about Disney animated movies. The princesses talk less now than they did in the older movies. We'll talk to a researcher about the quiet princesses and what they mean for kids.
And we'll hear from a state lawmaker who wants to offer student loan forgiveness for new farmers in Wisconsin.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.